Today, I am selfishly interviewing Dr. Morgan all about newborns. As I'm about to have our second baby, I needed a refresher on what to expect with a brand new baby. For any of you first-time moms or even subsequent mommies like me, you do not want to miss this one. We dive into the items you truly need, newborn sleep and newborn feeding, which are all such big topics they probably each need their own episode. Dr. Morgan's knowledge and wisdom are pure gold, and I'm so grateful that I was able to pick her brain on everything I didn't know or have forgotten. Hopefully you find it invaluable too. We will have a part two coming out where we go into even more topics on newborns, so keep an eye out for that next week. Let's go. Welcome to Healthy as a Mother, the podcast for becoming and being a mother, with your co-hosts, Dr. Leah Gordon and Dr. Morgan McDermott, two naturopathic doctors who get it.
Each week, we teach you how to be the healthiest mother you can be, from fertility and preconception to pregnancy and birth prep, through postpartum and throughout motherhood, empowering you with the natural health guidance and education you're not getting elsewhere, so you can confidently navigate the broken system at large.
The real, the raw, the untalked about. And remember, this information is not intended to diagnose, treat, or manage any disease. Always consult with your doctor before making any changes.
There is a lot of education out there for pregnancy and birth, and thank goodness for it. But what about postpartum? Many parents feel blindsided by how dynamic and intense the first few weeks with a newborn can be, and I've created a course to change that. Introducing the Immediate Postpartum Series. In this 11-video course, I teach you and your partner about all of the different types of decisions that need to be made right after your baby is born, the ways that your body and your baby's body will be changing rapidly over those first several days and weeks, how to recover from birth, whether it's a vaginal or cesarean delivery, how to establish breastfeeding, it's basically a breastfeeding 101 course, and the nuances of stool changes, diaper tricks, newborn sleep, placenta options, mindset, circumcision, and more, so that you and your partner know what to expect and can feel prepared and confident in what is normal and what is not, and get back to enjoying your new baby. Click the link in the show notes to start prepping now.
Okay, today we have a very special episode for me because I am about to have a baby again and I've forgotten everything about having a baby. And so I was going to ask Dr. Morgan all these questions anyways because she's my doula and my best friend and the expert on all things birth, but we figured you all would benefit from hearing all of this too. So we're going to dive into what I or anyone who's preparing for a birth needs to know about a newborn, from what they need to behavior and what I need to do. And I need all of this information fresh in my mind. It's been 3 years since I had my daughter, and motherhood amnesia is so real in the sense that you forget how hard things are, but then you also just forget everything in general, I think, about what to do. So I'm so excited that you can tell me.
Yeah, actually, this is so common. I've thought in the past, and I have like halfway outlined multiple offerings that are for subsequent parents, like where they already have some children, one, two, however many, because I hear this so often that people are like, I forgot everything. What do I do? Or like a little birth refresher course too for people who are heading into that phase. Like it is something that we learn, and then once we know it, we sort of know it in our bones. It's a little bit like riding a bike, but it's also like as if the bike was a bit more complicated and each bike was individual and you had to learn each individual bike separately because each baby is going to be different and times are different. You're a different person. You're a different mom. You know new things. Your body might behave differently. Like you might be more tired, or maybe you're healthier now than you were beforehand, or, you know, this baby is easier or more difficult than your other child. And so there's a lot of factors that play into this. But just know that you're not alone in thinking like, oh my gosh, I don't remember anything. It's really common. Yeah. So in this episode, I wanted to talk about the specific period of the quote unquote fourth trimester, which is the first 3 months of life, but even more specifically referring really to like the first month or two. Yeah. Because there is some sort of a sliding scale. I feel like under 8 weeks, a newborn is almost all the same, or maybe even under just like 6 weeks. And then between like 6 and 10 weeks, there's sort of like a transitioning baby. And then like a 3 month old is very different from that even. And it just continues to change. Every couple of weeks, you'll notice that your baby is more mature, doing different things, phasing out of other things, etc. But so for like little newborns, a lot of parents have a lot of anxiety about this. Like, what am I doing with them? What are they wearing? Where do they sleep? How much do they sleep? Where do they feed? etc. So I kind of broke down this outline of stuff I wanted to talk about. And yeah, some of the items that I think are helpful, we can link them as well. And so, yeah, let's just get going. So
yeah,
first of all, just a quick note on like, what are you going to be doing all day? So in my 6-week pregnancy call, that was a common question at the end of the call for the women who were getting closer to delivering. They were like, wait a minute, what am I, what, you know, and they were asking if I'd had any newborn resources, which now I can point to this a little bit, but at the end of the day, what you will be doing when your newborn baby has arrived is you will be doing a combination of focusing on your own birth recovery, however that went, vaginal or cesarean, and then feeding them, and they will be sleeping a lot. So the good thing about newborns when it comes to sleep is that most of them are very just, they fall asleep spontaneously. You do not need to put them to sleep. They will fall asleep sometimes nursing or at the bottle. They will just fall asleep randomly when you're doing anything else. They are very, very sleepy, and they sleep up to like 16, 17, 18 hours a day. So in a 24-hour period, that's a lot of sleep. It comes in.
Oh, I was going to say, but we're supposed to wake them up to feed them, right?
Yes. Oh, yeah. And we'll get there too about like what are the feeding guidelines and how do we do that at night specifically and when can we transition out of that? And that's like the basic advice that's given from lactation consultants and things. And so I'll get there in a second. But the sleep doesn't come in like, oh, my newborn took a 4-hour nap and then woke up and blah, blah, blah. It's like this is sleep that sometimes is coming in 20-minute chunks, maybe 45 or an hour, maybe like 2 hours sometimes. I would say, though, we need to really wrap our heads around the fact that this is just not the way that a fetal – or not fetal. Now, at this point, they're, you know, infants. Infant brain works. And you can't do anything about that. You cannot sleep train a little tiny newborn into – I mean, unless you're going to do cry it out with a newborn, which is ghastly. I would not ever suggest that. People do cry it out maybe at like 6 weeks, 12 weeks, something like that, which is still, in my opinion, not a great idea. There's lots of other ways to go about this. But if we have to at that point, then they are at least able to like make a behavioral change. It's still from an extinction point of view where they are just giving up on being responded to. And so they sleep. They are just not expecting to be responded to anymore, which has its problems. But a little newborn, like, you know, a month old, even sometimes, yeah, before that 6-week period, are not able to make behavioral changes based on like sleep training methods. And so this is a common area of misconception. Yes, you can kind of lay some sleep foundations at some point. I think that sleep foundations shouldn't probably come around until that like 6 to 8 week mark, because you're really just in survival mode. That first month, like, you're just getting used to this new situation. And if it's your second baby or third baby, you're now just getting used to the situation of having older children with a newborn. And it, we are stronger than we think. You are more able than maybe, you know, in your pregnant state, you're thinking that you are, and you're very nervous. And maybe now in your daily life, if you get a bad night of sleep, it really crushes your whole week. It's just different when we become mothers. Some part of that remains true, but also we have all these hormones and adrenaline is kicked in a different kind of a way, and cortisol. And there's an instinctual base level knowledge in the back of our mind that you don't have a choice. So it's like, sorry, you have this baby now that's dependent upon you, and your instinctual drive to care for them overrules your overall, like, you know, self-pity about not getting a good night of sleep. It just kind of is what it is. And this is where, like, nap when the baby naps, that this is where that comes from, because we need to shift our thinking. I've talked about this in the past before, but we have to shift our thinking from thinking we're going to get all of our sleep that we need in a 24-hour period at night into I'm going to get the sleep that I need in a 24-hour period broken up into chunks, kind of like my baby. So even if you can just get one 20-minute nap in the day, I mean, obviously more sleep than that in the daytime would be ideal, but that can be something that is really hard for people to implement. It's really hard for me to implement. I am not a napper. My body just like does not nap well. I try to prioritize it. And even if you're doing something like non-sleep deep rest, so it's NSDR. Yeah, NSDR. Wait, deep rest. Yes, NSDR. And I will put that in the show notes here. Let me just make a little note. NSDR. What's the guy with the beard? What's his name?
Santa Claus?
No. The neuroscientist.
Be more specific.
Yeah, the neuroscientist with the beard. The one.
Oh.
What's his, Huberman.
Oh, Huberman. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
He has some non-sleep deep rest resources that I can link to. So this is just the idea of getting into kind of this like different brainwave state and using rhythmic breathing and some relaxation techniques so that your body is able to drop into a state of restorative rest and recovery without actually being tipped into sleep, which is a skill that we all need to have. And it's really hard to stay asleep when you have a little noisy newborn next to you. And that's a whole other component to this is like they are loud, you know? Mm-hmm. And so not only do newborns sleep in these very kind of like fitful bursts, but they make a lot of sounds even when they are actually asleep. And this can kind of be shocking to people. So I wanted to make a particular note about this, that they can like even sometimes sound like they're fully crying out, but they are asleep. So there is this idea in the book called Growing Up Bebe, like B-E-B-E. Hmm. Again, I'll put that in the show notes here. Or maybe can you take a note on that for me?
Yeah.
You're like, what's the, on the Joe Rogan podcast, his Jamie, you're like Jamie.
Oh, can you write that down? Doing all the notes. Yep. Yeah. Growing up, bebe.
Okay. Growing up, bebe.
Good I can listen.
Yes. So that is a book that's about the way that the French raise their children. And there's this idea in their culture called the pause. And so it's when your baby makes a noise or start or like, you know, cries or does something while they're sleeping at night or in the daytime, you just hang out for just a couple minutes or even just a couple seconds, 30 seconds, and you just watch and wait because, first of all, they may not actually even be awake. And that's a very common situation with newborns. But then with older infants and children, sometimes they will just settle and put themselves back together. Or if it's like older actual children, they may just be having a dream or sleep talking or something like that. And if we go rush to them because we are, you know, we want to respond to our babies, which is a good, beautiful thing, but we need to also just sort of give them their own space. They are their own autonomous beings. And if they are truly asking for help by eliciting crying, since that's the only way that a baby can communicate with us is through crying, then we go to them, of course. But if you can just watch your newborn for just like 35 seconds, you may be shocked that they will go back to sleep. Or they're sometimes going to move their head back and forth or suck on their hands, and then they'll just sort of like resettle. Mm-hmm. So there is this thing that we should be kind of like trying out from the beginning, which is the pause, and knowing that they make a lot of sounds. Now another question is just like, well, where does the baby sleep? Yes. There's some options for this. So there is co-sleeping literally in the bed. So bed sharing, I'm going to call it bed sharing. And I'm going to kind of move from the options out. And this is going to depend on you. I'm just going to give you the options here. So there is bed sharing physically in the bed with you. There is co-sleeping, which could mean something like that, which means, you know, in the bed, or it could be in a bedside bassinet, which is like, they're really cool. They can kind of go up and down so that they will be the exact level of your bed. I had one from Baby Delight with Sunday. Can you put Baby Delight in the show notes, too, please? That was awesome because I was able to adjust the height of it. And you can also adjust one, like the right or the left leg. So when she was dealing with reflux, I would sometimes have one of the sides clicked up like 1 inch higher so that it was just a little bit angled. You do need to get clearance from your pediatrician to do that and do it properly and safely, but it can be helpful with babies that have reflux. Either way, it sits right up against the edge of the bed so that you can respond to them easily at night to pull them in to nurse or to put a hand on them, to shush them, to settle them, to be there. And they can also hear you subconsciously in a newborn brain. Their nervous system is attuning to you. So their heart rate and their breathing rate, their respiratory rate, will sync with that of the mother just by a mechanism that is very, you know, reptilian and instinctual in our brains. It's not like they're doing it on purpose, but being able to either feel your heartbeat or hear you breathing by, you know, however close they are in proximity to you is very soothing for a baby. You have to think about this baby grew in your body and only knows you, knows your voice. I mean, yes, maybe they know the voice of your other family members, but their whole sense of their entire world is that rhythmic sound of your heartbeat. Mm-hmm. And sound of your breathing. And so when they come out, they really don't want to be separated from mom. And this is sometimes also a big surprise to new families, is that, you know, some babies don't often want to be with anyone besides mom. So that includes dad. Mm-hmm. And sometimes dads can feel really left out, or other female partner, whoever it is, but they're not attuned to that person. They're attuned to the person that they grew in their womb. And so you can't take offense to this. It's a newborn. Don't take it personally, but we do need to wrap our heads around the fact that the best way to support a new mom is to not help her with her baby. It's to help her with all of the other things that she normally does, so that she can take care of the baby. Yeah. Yes, somebody else could change a diaper or whatever, but most of the time, baby is going to be want to be on mom. Mom is going to be the one feeding it, unless we're formula feeding, then other people can too. But just know that it is, or, you know, exclusively pumping or something like that, where there's a bottle. Some other people can take place in that, or take part in that. And that is a way that there can be bonding, but just know that it is a very, very common experience for mom to really be the predominant, you know, 90 to 100% caretaker of the baby. And then other people are feeding her, cleaning the house, mm-hmm. taking the dog on a walk, tending to the other children, doing all the other things that mom's job load was beforehand. Yeah. So that she can just solely focus on the baby and her own healing, mm-hmm. whether that be with, you know, making sure she's resting when she can and eating and just soaking up this very precious window of that first couple of weeks with a newborn, because you can never get it back. Mm-hmm. And it's something that is really sad to me about subsequent children. And so it'll be interesting for you how this works. I mean, not to like be a downer on you, but it will be different than it was with your daughter, because she's around now. And so it's hard to be able to focus on our subsequent kids. And it kind of feels tragic, because it feels like we're maybe not spending enough time with them. But as you've noticed, even just with your pregnancy, it's like, we don't have time to even think about the fact that we're pregnant when we have other kids. And then we have this other baby coming, and it's like, oh my gosh. And you will make room for him in your life, but it will be different. And there's just a little bit of like sorrow for that in that for me. I think it's just kind of something where like your first newborn is going to be a very different experience than any of your other newborns.
I feel like I really soaked up postpartum with Avia, and even now, just trying to get work done or try to do anything, you know, she needs me all the time. And it's just like, I just like, don't even know what it's going to be like to have him. That's why I'm hiring some nanny type people who could come and help cook and clean and do that kind of stuff. Because I really resonate with that idea that people are always like, let me come over and hold the baby. It's like, no, come over and cook me meals and clean the house. I'll hold the baby. Yes. So I love that.
Exactly. And then,
for sleeping, so I had a halo bassinet with Avia, and that was really cool too, because it like swivels and you can move it to the bed. Is there ever a time that they have to be on you? Like, do you automatically put them, and then do you have to swaddle them when you put them in the bassinet?
Yes. Okay. So I kind of got off.
I forget. I know I had her sleep on her belly sooner than what is like technically advised, but that worked for her. But I can't remember when I did that.
Yes. Okay. So let me continue. So there's these bedside bassinets that can be right up against the bed. Then you can have a bassinet that is just in the room. Like, there's the pack and play topper bassinets. There's the halo. There's, you know, any other kind of like the Baby Delight one, some, you know, the Newton, there's mm-hmm. a million different brands, right? So just something that the baby has to sleep in. So, and when it comes to like items that babies need, really quick, let me just slide this in here. There's not that many things that a baby actually needs. So here's the list of things that a baby actually needs.
Okay.
Diapers and wipes.
Yep.
Clothes. Food of some kind, whether that's breast milk or formula. And then of course, there's sometimes items to go along with that, if it's bottles or whatever. They need a place to sleep. So that's what we're talking about right now. So it could be literally just in the bed with you. It could be a crib, whatever. And then I do think it's a good idea to have a thermometer and a nail file. And that's it.
Do you have any recommended brands of thermometers?
Yes. Well, for thermometers, not really. I think that any kind of little just, you know, okay, thermometers with a baby, the most accurate temperature is going to be rectal. So that just is the way it is. Make sure you label your thermometer properly. If you're going to use a rectal thermometer, you just write rectal on it. And then if you have an oral one, you write oral. You're not going to take an oral temperature though on a newborn. You are either going to do something in the armpit or again up the anus. For nail files or nail things, my favorite, and I think I'm on the like small end of this, but I love the Nail Frida, like Frida Baby, that brand, Frida Baby, nail clippers. And
yeah, I got those probably because you told me to, and I love them. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that they're awesome. So a lot of people think that it's like super hard to clip a newborn nails and that they prefer to do the filing, or they have like those little Dremel drill kind of things that like, you know, electric and they spin, and you can do that too. I just find that that takes such a long time.
Yeah. No, I loved the nail clippers. I never felt like I was going to cut her.
Good. Okay. So my only piece of advice about the nail clippers, just make sure, is that a newborn, just that first clipping, their skin on the inside of the nail, up even at the tip, even if they're born with these long nails, you still need to take your own nail and kind of peel in between the nail and the skin and make sure that it comes separate so that there is a space between skin and nail. And you can kind of like push it down a little bit under their nail there, because it can be almost like attached, and they're so soft and everything is so soft. And oh my gosh, I learned this the hard way with my second, and I just started clipping her nails, and then she bled on like 4 or 5 fingers before I even realized what was happening. She didn't even, her cry was delayed too, but then all of a sudden she started bleeding and screaming, and it was horrible. And I like will never forget about that, you know, and I felt so bad. Because I didn't do that. Her nails were long, and I went to go clip, and it seemed like I was clipping just the nail, but on the backside, there was a little membrane of skin that was attached, and you have to push that down. Yep.
Good.
So, but anyways, about beds and sleeping and things. So if you're going to co-sleep in the bed with your baby, we do not swaddle. We do not swaddle babies that are bed sharing with us. That's because they can get overheated. I mean, some people are going to do this, but it's not advised. You also typically will have them on their back or their side, and you don't want to have a swaddled baby on their side, because if they did flip, it's harder for, they need to be able to have their hands. And newborns are stronger than you think. Newborns can start sleeping on the belly. They actually love it. They love sleeping on their chest, on, like chest to chest with a mom or care provider in general. And they can move their heads. I mean, they can do the breast crawl minutes after birth. They are a lot stronger than we give them credit for, but they certainly can't do it if their arms are tucked underneath them like a little seal pup. Like they need to be able to push, and they're not going to like do this huge push up and, you know, like a 4-month-old or something like that, but they will be able to move their head from side to side, and they need to be able to have that range of motion. The reason why we swaddle is because it does mimic the tightness and the comfort of the womb, and it mitigates something called the Morrow reflex or the startle reflex, which is where a baby who's on their back will like throw their arms out and kind of like all their fingers are spread, and their nervous system, you can tell it's in this like little moment of fight or flight, and it's like, wah, you know. And often babies, when they're born, you'll see pictures of them like being handed up to mom and their arms are out like this. Like that's the, that's the the Morrow reflex, and it's reflex. It's adaptive. It's important. It's one of those primitive reflexes that they have. It's like you, it is what it is. And it makes sleep a little bit tricky because they might actually be like waking themselves up and startling if they are not swaddled. Now, there is some controversy with swaddling because it does restrict their movement. And so what I think about swaddling is, if you're going to have your baby sleeping on their back and you're not holding them all night in a like cuddle curl from bed sharing, then they probably need to be swaddled. And I think that that's okay for a period of time. We should try to transition out of the swaddle as soon as possible and allow babies to have more range of motion and also find their hands for self-soothing and sucking and things like that. Every parent's going to do whatever you need to do, and every baby is different. So I swaddled my son and he loved it. My first daughter was born, and I didn't even know what else to do with her because I assumed I would swaddle, and she hated the swaddle so much. She didn't want to sleep on her back at all. And she would make all these like weird gurgling sounds and stuff at night. And it was probably a mix of normal newborn sound, but also it was freaky to me. And so one day for a nap, this is at like 8 days old, I put her on her belly and I was there and I was watching her and stuff, and she slept so well. And so then for me, I made the decision to have her sleep on her belly ever since. And then I did the same thing with the two subsequent girls. So all three of my girls have slept on their bellies either right after birth or, you know, within that 8-day period, whatever it is. So then they didn't have any swaddle. And when they're sleeping on their bellies, their Morrow reflex is naturally inhibited because they can't startle into the bed. And this is, you know, chest sleeping, which is where, but I have to say, belly sleeping is not recommended. It is recommended against by the American Academy of Pediatrics. So this is not suggesting that that is what you should or need to do. I'm just giving other options of things that can happen. With my baby that had laryngomalacia, that was actually one of the things that was recommended because of the way the airway is more open when they're on their belly. And she had this floppy tissue that was blocking it sometimes. And so there are sometimes situations like that. But chest sleeping is something that you can do safely. There's an Instagram account called CoSleepy, and it's a little bit intense. I don't think that it needs to be like every single video. I don't know. Like sometimes I just feel like some of these educational resources can be a little bit like extreme or intense. So just take it with a grain of salt, just like everything, right? But there is a highlight on her Instagram account. So we'll put that in the show notes as well.
Yeah.
It's called chest sleeping, and that it shows you how you can do it safely. And it's like, well, what do you mean? What is chest sleeping? That's like literally where the baby is chest to chest sleeping on you. And you can be in your bed. That's really where you need to be. Sleeping on a couch with a baby is something that's common, and it's very dangerous. That is one of the worst places that we can sleep with our babies. And it's common because people are so tired. And mm-hmm. it's like maybe one of the parents is taking the baby out into the living room to give the other parent some uninterrupted sleep in the bed, but then they end up falling asleep on the couch. They're so sleep deprived. The baby is on their chest and then slides in towards the back of the couch, and you know, there's a SIDS event, something like that. So we need to be doing this consciously and carefully, and know that there are positions for babies that are safe and positions that aren't, right? When mm-hmm. you're going to be bed sharing, there's also something called the Safe Sleep 7. Lots of S's. Put that in the show notes as well. And it's sort of these like general guidelines that parents need to not be intoxicated. They can't be smokers. There needs to be like, you know, no blankets and pillows around the baby's head, et cetera, so that we make sure we're doing this properly. We need to understand that this is where humans came from. This is human like nature 101 to sleep right next to our infants, because we never put them in a different room in the hut, you know, mm-hmm. that wouldn't have been safe. No mammals do that. All mammals sleep together. Now as humans in modern day society, it can be something that people don't really like to do, want to do. They feel fearful, or they have a hard time sleeping, which I know is something that you've mentioned before, mm-hmm. that you have a really hard time sleeping next to a baby, which I can relate to as well. And so for me, I've kind of done a little bit of a blend, I guess, is that mm-hmm. they sleep in the bed with me for that first like month, and then they start to transition into that little bedside thing. And then as time goes on, slowly, I just sort of transition them further and further away from the bed so that I'm not waking them up, because that's always something I think about too. And then mm-hmm. they go in their own room in a crib. So everyone is going to be different with this, but just know that there is a general recommendation though, that babies are in the room with you. I think, is it 8 or 12 weeks? I think it's maybe just maybe it is 12 weeks. That was just surprising to me. So room sharing, that you are room sharing with your infant for that first 3 months. Maybe it's 2 months, something like that. Yeah. Even by the American Academy of Pediatrics, which is like, you know, for them to say something like that is surprising to me. Mm-hmm. But it's because there is lower SIDS risks in babies that are sharing the room with the parents, because they can respond to the baby better. Mm-hmm. Now, it's also like, well, if there is a monitor in the room across the hall, is that the same thing? I don't know. Whatever. Again, this is just some like options, things to think about. Know that every parent in the world is trying to do the best they can with this, and like with their means and what they can make work with their own family, and then what also works with their baby. There's this intersection of all these things. With Sunday, with my fourth, I really, 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 really wanted to co-sleep with her, like in the bed. I wanted a bed share with her. I wanted a baby in my bed for years, because mm-hmm. she's our last one. And it was not working. It could not work. I tried so hard. I tried harder than I probably should have, because I was having these like terrible nights of sleep, but mm-hmm. She would just roll into me, or like bump into me, or I would roll and move and it would wake her up. And so I don't know, to me, this is still an area where I wish I could have an experience where I just was like able to jump into a different person's body for like a week and co-sleep with their babies and see what that was actually like in the middle of the night, because I still don't even know. But it sounds like it went a lot better than it did for me. And so I wasn't able to do that. And then because she had laryngeal malacia, I did move her into her own room at 8 weeks, which is against the recommendation. And she was so loud. I was actually starting to go insane. So you got to do what you got to do. So I'm kind of giving a lot of stories mm-hmm. and options of the way that this can go. Meanwhile, my son slept in our room with us for 9 months, then the second daughter for 6 months, the third daughter for, or the whatever, the third baby for about 6 months, and then Sunday for only 2 months. And so this is just to highlight the temperament of your child is really going to dictate a lot of what happens here. And some babies are going to be really excellent sleepers right from the get-go. And when you move them into their own space, they're going to sleep even better because, maybe they don't get woken up by dad snoring or shifting around in the night or other children coming in. So that's another thing in these families that have more kids is you may have to tend to other people in the middle of the night, and then that wakes everybody up, or you might have older kids coming into the bed, and there is some safety concerns with that too. We need to be like conscious of, really technically only parents should be sleeping right next to the newborn baby. As the baby gets older and more robust and strong, and they, you know, this is the way that it goes around the world. This is human nature to have multiple kids sleeping in a bed with the parents too. But anyway, so that's kind of like the places where they can sleep. Any questions or thoughts about that?
No, but it just sounds like having options and being flexible, because I think, like, for me, having the second baby, not assuming it's going to be exactly the same as it was with Avia, or I mean, I see this too along the fertility journey of like, well, this is exactly how it's going to go. And then it doesn't. And so just, I think the moral of the story for anyone listening, and for me too, is to know the options and also be flexible. I know myself too, in the sense that I'm a better mom and a better person when I can sleep. And so I'll probably do a hybrid, which is probably what I did with Avia too, where she slept in the bed with me for just a little bit. And then I put her right next to me in a bassinet, because I get woken up by every single little thing. And so, but we'll see what happens with this baby. You know, she's very independent. She's a kapha. She's a great sleeper. He might not be. We'll see. I don't know. But that's why.
I hope he is for you. But yeah, you just don't know. And it changes too. So like, they may start out one particular way, and then as they've gone through different developmental phases, or they get to be a certain weight, all of a sudden things change. So
yeah,
this is one aspect actually of parenting that I find to be really exhausting, is this constant recheck-in of what's working, what's not, and troubleshooting and trying new things, because it's kind of human nature, I think, to want to pick one way and just go with it and go gung-ho, especially if you're type A, or you're very like, I don't know, like one of those kinds of people who's organized and neurotic and sort of like, I'm going to pick this path, and then they stick to it, and they're like very disciplined in that sort of a way, which I am actually not disciplined in a lot of ways, but I don't love the idea of trying new things all the time. Whereas my husband does. He's always like, well, let's just try it. Let's try this. Let's try that. I'm like, I don't want to try anything else.
I know. I'm tired. I remember with Avia that we transitioned her to her belly too. I don't remember when, but that it was like all better from there.
And now a moment from our sponsor. If you are looking for a delicious and effective immune supplement that your entire family can use, from children through adults and even while pregnant and breastfeeding, look no further than the needed immune support powder. With elderberry, zinc, pre and probiotics, beta-glucans, and arabinogalactans, the needed immune support powder is a very tasty berry treat that you can easily mix into water, yogurt, popsicle recipes, smoothies, gummies, and more. It's something that I always have on hand and give at the first sign of illness to any of my children as well as myself. Give it a try by visiting thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20% off your first order. Again, visit thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20%.
My other question is pacifiers. So
yes,
I remember distinctly, it's like my whole postpartum is just a blur and I just have a few memories, but I do remember distinctly having her in that bassinet and we were swaddling her. But then she's such a person who soothes with something in her mouth. And even now she's three and she still sucks her fingers, which is really cute, even though all of the orofacial people are like cringing, I'm sure, that she still does that. But it's like, that's how she self-soothes herself. And so we did give her a pacifier, but I don't remember when that started. And then she eventually weaned herself from the pacifier, but she replaced it with her fingers.
Yes. Okay. So pacifiers, the reason why I didn't put those on the list is because I was just trying to give the quickest sort of like bare minimum list. Now there's also obviously tons of other baby items, swings and pacifiers and bumbos and different like toys or baby carriers. I do think a baby carrier is one to add onto the bare minimum list as well. But so with pacifiers, the thing is that ideally what we want to do is ensure that the baby has a really good latch, is nursing at the breast well, and is gaining weight before we introduce a pacifier. So I would say typical recommendations around pacifiers are like not before 2 or 3 weeks. So at the 2 or 3 week mark, now we can start to introduce a pacifier, and we still need to be conscious. The problem with pacifiers, and I was getting in some like Instagram comment fights about this the other day on one of my reels, is because people were like, my baby sucked a pacifier and everything was fine with my breast milk supply. And I'm like, cool, good for you. The problem isn't that you gave them a pacifier, or they were assuming that what I meant in one of the reels that I was mentioning about trying to delay pacifier use was that there is nipple confusion. Nipple confusion is this idea, which I do think is legitimately the case for some babies, not as common as it sometimes is made out to be though. It's a little bit overrated. overhyped as a thing. Nipple confusion is like when you give a baby a bottle and you're trying to like nurse and give them bottles. Maybe you're pumping or you're trying to get your supply back up or whatever, something like that happened. And then they decide that they prefer the bottle over the nipple, or they decide that they prefer the shape of a pacifier over your nipple. What really is happening here though, usually, is that the baby has some sort of a dysfunction with their latch where they can't attach at the breast as easily as something that's hard and plastic and sticks out. And that mm-hmm. is a problem with the latch. Or sometimes both, you have given the baby a bottle at a flow rate that is much faster than the natural flow rate of breast milk. And if we know anything about basic breast milk physiology, or breastfeeding physiology, a baby sucks at the breast. They do get a couple of little mouthfuls of once, let's just pretend it's once they've transitioned to actual like real white milk. And it's not just colostrum milk anymore. They have to suck for a little bit of time before they get the letdown. The letdown is where then now the milk is like shooting into their mouth, or it's at least more flowing more freely. When they just suck on a bottle, they get milk immediately. And so they have mm-hmm. to work way less hard. So again, though, babies that have something wrong with their mouth or their latch, whether it's tight or tied or small or they're preemie or whatever is happening, or mom's nipples are inverted or flat and they need a little bit more support with that, a baby is obviously going to choose the path of least resistance. And if mm-hmm. it's, okay, wait a minute, time out. This thing goes in my mouth, I immediately start sucking on my food and it's way easier to get, then probably, yeah, I'm going to cry when I'm off of the breast. So we need to be cognizant of that. But that's not the problem with pacifiers. The problem with pacifiers is that people give them to the baby when the baby starts crying. And the baby may be crying because they're hungry. Mm-hmm. And in that first month, at least, I think any time really that the baby is fussing, we should be offering the breast.
Yeah.
If you know for sure, your baby just had a great feed, they have a good latch, you know that they're gaining weight, you know that there's no way on this earth that they are hungry or thirsty, but they are still fussing, which is totally normal because babies cry for a lot of reasons, which we'll talk about in a minute. Then I think that we can offer the pacifier. We use it as a tool, not as a babysitter, not as a, you know, shut up plug, not mm-hmm. as a meal replacement, because that is something that damages milk supply. Hands down, no ifs, ands, or buts about it. It is the way that it is. And people want to act like it doesn't matter. And they're like, well, you can give your baby. It's like, yeah, sure, you can if your baby has a good latch and they're gaining. But there's a lot of babies out there that that's not the case. And then women are left in this situation where they didn't know that. And slowly their milk supply has been eroded over time. Less and less and less milk is going out because their baby is cueing hunger and having a pacifier slammed in their mouth instead of being offered the breast to mm-hmm. have a little feed here, a little feed there. That's how sometimes babies feed. They don't usually feed 4 ounces at a feed for a long time, like 4 months, 5 months. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So we just need to use a pacifier in a smart way. And some of the problem can be at night too, is that a baby is physiologically adapted to wake up at night to feed for a long period of time. Now, mm-hmm. in our modern world, we do kind of want that to stop earlier. And, you know, there's going to be people who sleep train their baby at 6, 12 weeks, whatever, and they are sleeping 12 hours with no feeds. I think that's a overall more rare situation of success than it's given, because a lot of people are not going to be able to maintain their milk supply if they are not also having a 1, 2, if not, you know, 3 overnight feeds for a period of time.
Yeah. Can we talk about feeding? Because yes, I'm trying to remember with Avia, I don't think I ever used the pacifier to replace food. I feel like it was once I fed her to help her sleep, but then I'm thinking, wait, what's the pattern that we're supposed to go? And I don't remember of like, do we feed and then sleep them or sleep them and then play? I can't remember.
Yeah. Okay. So let me get there in just a second. I just want to say one other thing to know about newborns that is important for parents to start to learn about is this idea of wake windows. Wake windows are important. So the developmental brain can really only be stimulated for so long before it needs to drop back into sleep. And if we are following our baby's wake windows, we'll notice that it's actually way easier for them to sleep. They will get more sleep. And then this idea that like sleep begets sleep, like the more sleep that they get, the more likely that they're going to sleep easier is true. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so wake windows are from the time that your baby wakes up, like truly is awake, not just making noises, right? So they're actually awake. And then you feed them and you change their diaper and you maybe change their clothes or you're like wearing them. Most newborns in that first like 4, 6, 8 weeks only have a wake window of 45 to 60 minutes before mm-hmm. they need to go back to sleep again. And they may, in that beginning, just fall asleep. You're not putting them to sleep. They're just going to be falling back asleep at the end of that window. But at some point, I feel like for my kids, it's always been around 6 weeks where I notice like, oh, holy crap, this baby's been awake for like 2 hours. Like, what's going on? Because then there is a transition that happens where they are not going to just fall asleep on their will, because they're kind of more aware of their environment and they're like watching things and they get FOMO mm-hmm. and, you know, they want to be included. So you have to then put them to sleep at these intervals. And so it is a really big game changer. There's an app called the Wonder Weeks app, which we'll put in the show notes, which is mm-hmm. a couple of dollars, maybe it's like $5. It is a game changer. You can have the one app for all of your kids. You just input their new information when you have a new baby. It will tell you when they are having these big neurodevelopmental changes going on through that first year of their life and beyond. And it's like what to expect. So when is a baby starting to be able to see across the room? And what does that do to their behavior? Like, we have to imagine, if you've ever tried to learn a new language or something, and you're learning a lot, and it's very exhausting to the brain, and it can make you grumpy, and it can make you tired. And, you know, when we're in school and everything's new, like when there's new learning curves to anything, which new parenthood is filled with, mm-hmm. It makes you kind of tired and grumpy. And same thing for a baby. They're changing so fast. There is so many new things, like just their ability to understand patterns or routines or to see faces and all this different stuff. And it does make them more fussy. So this app really helps you to know when your baby is likely to be in these windows so that you can understand if you're like, dang, what is happening? Like, she was so happy last week and now this week she's just like overall fussy. Mm-hmm. It's not that that's just the way your baby now is for the rest of their life. It's that they're probably in a leap. They're probably mm-hmm. in one of these developmental leaps, LEAP, that's what they're called. So anyway, know about that. But so this wake window idea is also, I think we need to conjoin some of these philosophies to understanding what's happening with our newborn and what are we doing with them. And then in terms of sleep foundations, before we move on to feeding, again, real quickly, I'm going to outline what I would say is the first month is a crapshoot. You're not trying to do sleep foundations. You're just trying to survive. I don't even think a baby can actually take on any idea of sleep foundations for a while anyway. So it's a waste of time, mm-hmm. in my opinion. Okay, this is – you can do what you want. You can read about other stuff, whatever. But this is what I've experienced with my four kids.
I love your opinions.
This month is still mostly a crapshoot, but maybe you can start to implement some things like, you know, you're starting to maybe put them awake – or put them down for a nap drowsy but awake still, so that they have to have a few minutes of soothing. Hopefully that doesn't entail a lot of crying, but like maybe they're just, you know, rubbing their heads back and forth and maybe a little whining, or they're like sucking on their hand, or they're sucking on a pacifier, and then they fall asleep on their own. They fall asleep independently. There is benefit definitely to encouraging these behaviors for sure. Mm-hmm. And know that if your baby isn't doing that and they, no matter what you do, they won't do it by themselves, that is the temperament of your baby. And it's not that you're doing anything wrong. Some will do it, some won't. So that is something that's omitted in all of this sleep training information, is like, it's just like as if they're robots, like you do this and that, this is what's going to happen. And it's like, no, we are people with real opinions and behaviors and temperaments and all these different things. And like, I think sometimes what can happen too is people have one kid that slept well or something went well, and they're like, well, it's because I did it right. And it's like, well, probably not, actually. You probably mm-hmm. just got really lucky, and that's cool. And I'm super happy for you. And I really hope that happens again. If it doesn't, don't be hard on yourself thinking that you're doing something wrong. It just is the way that it is, and we have to adapt. So second month is kind of wishy-washy. After that, I think that, yeah, maybe like somewhere between 8 and 10 weeks, getting close to that third month, some of these sleep foundations, like sleeping in a dark room with a noise machine, that's, you know, cool. These things are, you can start these things right off the bat with a noise machine in the dark and whatever. I just don't think it matters as much until the baby is a little bit older. Mm-hmm. Now, establishing a routine, something like, you know, when you put on the sleep sack or you read a book or, you know, the bath or whatever it is that you do with your baby, that you have a routine, that will make a bigger difference to these older infants, these like 8, 10 week olds. So then maybe that's when you decide to impart something like that. And so then you get really consistent about what you say and the songs you sing and whatever, and you're creating a routine. And maybe you're also following that pattern, which is what you were mentioning earlier. It's called eat, play, sleep. EPS, okay. EPS, eat, play, sleep.
Play, so sleep.
The whole idea there is that we are not getting the baby into the habit of nursing to sleep. But right. I have to say, I don't actually think it matters. Mm-hmm. I think nursing to sleep is really, really common. So many people do it, and you can do it for as long as it makes sense for you. If it's easier for you to nurse the baby completely to sleep and then set the baby down, they're going to sleep, versus spending 25 minutes in this battle with your baby who needs more soothing to fall asleep on their own. Like, why would we do that to ourselves? Mm-hmm. You can do that later when you have the 6-month-old that you're trying to now get to sleep independently a little bit easier. We can always change our mind. We can always pick a different way and change a sleep association. You can change a sleep crutch. Like, I think there's a lot of fear parents have where they're like, oh my God, if I do that, I'll never get out of it. And it's like, no, are you kidding? What, you think if you start letting your kid watch a show in the morning time that's just going to be the way it's going to be for the rest of their entire life and you can never change it? You can never step in and intervene as a parent and be like, hey, we don't do that anymore. We wake up and we go on a walk. Like, no, of course not. It's so stupid. It's so stupid. And we are always able to make new changes. And I think now, after the wisdom of having 4 kids, there is so much out there that's like so strict about the way that we interact with our kids that really omits and forgets this idea that like we have to flow in the moment with what works for us. Yeah. So if you're sitting there and you're nursing your baby completely to sleep and you're like stressing out about it because, shoot, you shouldn't have done that. Now you've ruined everything. Like, the stress of that, I believe to be way more, and just anxiety producing feelings and then mm-hmm. like shame and whatever it is, angst that might come from that, is way more detrimental than the baby being nursed to sleep, which is physiologically exactly what the baby expects to be able to do all the time. Mm-hmm. So I just don't subscribe to that idea. So, but you know, there's going to be things that we like swaddles. You can't keep your baby swaddled forever. And nobody talks about swaddles like they're a sleep crutch. Oh, maybe sometimes people do, but it's like you do it for a period of time and then you have to transition out of it because it's not safe anymore. And yeah, does that have a transition? And is that kind of hard sometimes? Yes, of course. Yes, of course it is. Same thing with pacifiers. You can use them for a period of time. You can't use them forever. You can nurse your baby to sleep for a period of time. You don't usually nurse your baby to sleep forever, although lots of people do. But you know, it's like, and at some point, parents of toddlers who are like 2 years old and the baby doesn't know how to sleep without nursing to sleep. Yeah, that's annoying. That's definitely really hard. That parent could have made a choice at any other time along the way though, and they just didn't because it worked for them. They didn't mm-hmm. want to do it. The idea of them needing to change the behavior never superseded staying in the behavior. So they didn't mm-hmm. change it. So don't let anybody make you feel like, oh my God, never start doing that because you'll never get out of it. Yes, you will. When you start to get sick of it and annoyed with it, you'll make the change and you won't do it anymore. And then there's going to be a couple hard days. Your baby's learning a new pattern. You're learning a new pattern. Like, it is just the way that it is, you know, but I feel like there's so much pressure on parents to like never make a mistake about their kids sleep. And it's just silly. So anyway, that's what I have to say about sleep.
Preach.
Preach. I don't, right?
I wonder if you're passionate about this. I can't tell. I'm not sure if you like this or not.
I know. Let's see. I do feel strongly about this because it's just, I hear so much like really dogmatic stuff about like people just ruining things. And it's just, I don't know. I think the thing that is more important is holding boundaries with your older kids mm-hmm. when you say no. That is actually something that matters. If you continue to make your no meaningless because you tell your kid no for an hour and then all of a sudden now you tell them yes.
Yeah.
That is going to, you know, erode your relationship or erode their behavior. But being flexible with a baby,
a newborn,
0 to 12-month-old baby.
Right.
Like, are you kidding? I just think that we need to remember what is happening and who is before us and that this baby came out completely expecting to be able to nurse and put as their main comfort for every single little thing. Mm-hmm. So anyway, okay. Now feeding. So you're asking about feeding. Okay, wait, really quick. I didn't define what eat, play, sleep means. So that means that they wake up from their nap, they eat right away, and then they play or you hang out with them or you change their diaper or you do whatever with them. And then they are falling asleep without like that immediately full belly or with that association of sucking to sleep, whether that's at the bottle or the breast. Okay. So with feeding, some just general guidelines to expect. So if you're, I'll talk about the two scenarios, if you're breastfeeding or if you're formula feeding. So when your baby is born, they are going to be drinking only colostrum. Colostrum is still milk. It's just a different form of milk. Ideally, what is going to happen is that you're nursing them every hour and a half to 2 to maybe maximum 3 hours around the clock until your milk has transitioned into that white creamy milk and the baby has regained birth weight. Okay. So,
and you feed them even if they're not showing hunger cues. You're just like, it's time, because you're trying to keep your supply up.
Yeah.
Because I know some babies are super sleepy and they're just like, And some people will be like, oh, my baby's sleeping so well. And they just let them keep sleeping.
Yes. And that's a tricky gray area because some babies are sleepy and they have a full belly and they're gaining weight beautifully and it's fine. Some babies are sleepy and it's because they're starving and they're starting to shut down and they don't have enough energy to signal. And I know that sounds nuts, but that happened to me. That's the story of my first son or my first child is I thought that everything was chilling and fine and it was not. And so it's a gray area. We need to be kind of like, I guess the way that you could tell if your sleepy baby, no, when I say sleepy baby, what we mean by this is that like the baby is literally almost never awake or the second that they start to latch or feed, they basically just fall back asleep. And so it's extremely lethargic, extremely sleepy newborn status. I always think it's best to have an IBCLC as part of your team when this is happening, which is an international board certified lactation consultant. Just know lactation consultants in hospitals are notorious for not being that helpful beyond just the normal lactational advice. If there's something going on beyond that, you need to be seeking more of an expert, which would be the IBCLC, in my opinion. People have different opinions about that, but I've just seen it time and time again. So what we would be doing ideally is, yeah, you're feeding the baby at that interval. So it's I would say most newborns, 99% of newborns will signal that they're going to want to feed every hour and a half to 3 hours. And if they don't for some reason, yeah, we need to look into that. But I would say if you are just like dealing with them and, you know, they're going to kind of get roused, then yeah, you do. You just sort of put them to the breast for a while. This is maybe going to happen for like the first week. This is like 7 days that we're doing this, okay? Around the clock, we're feeding them. It feels really disorienting. Days and nights are mixed up and everything's like all over the place. And you're like, what the hell am I doing? I'm only feeding this baby. And it will change. That's not the way that your life is now for the rest of your life. But in the very beginning, when we are pulling in our milk supply and we are transitioning our baby into like life on earth, there's a lot of nursing. There's so much going on for them. There's so much going on for you and your body and all your hormones are changing into this state of lactation. Prior, we were in a state of pregnancy. And now we are in a state of lactation and they're two hormonally completely different pictures and it takes time for that to happen. And the baby is doing all kinds of huge major changes as they transition into this new world. And so they may want to nurse not only because they're hungry, but because they're cold or they have pain or their stomach hurts or they're a little bit sad or overstimulated. There's a lot of reasons. We need to erase the idea that there's a potential of overfeeding a baby at the breast. You cannot overfeed a baby at the breast. It's just not possible. They nurse and suckle for a lot of other things besides just food. Do they happen to get milk when they're in that process? Yes. But that doesn't mean that they are overfeeding. They will regulate like and have a snack here and then maybe a little bit more there and whatever. And if your baby is really big and chunky and fat, there's no concern to that. That's okay. Yeah. There's literally no reason to be upset about this, but
I had a super fat and chunky baby. Yes. Which is the best.
It is the best. And it's like, there is an adage, I think, like maybe, you know, in the earlier generations or something where they thought that there was a potential of like obese babies and it's just not the case. Now with formula, it's a little bit different. Maybe there is, we could be watching them, but it's not possible with breast milk. So anyway, you want to be feeding them around the clock, including in the middle of the night. Now, this is something the parents don't like to hear, but it's true. Until your baby has regained their birth weight, which it's a common thing, in case you don't know, that they will lose weight after they are born. Some babies lose only a couple ounces and then they regain it really fast because they're excellent nursers and it never was an issue. And like by the time you're discharged from the hospital or by the time your midwife comes back to check on you at day three, the baby's already regained their birth weight. And that's amazing. That happens sometimes. What's more common is that it takes about a week. But it definitely needs to be back to birth weight by like 3 weeks. That's definitely on the longer end of things. And they also need to be not losing too much weight. It can be up to 10% of their body weight. Anyway, you don't need to worry about all that. Hopefully your postpartum team will be helping you. But do just know until that happens throughout the night, even if your baby is sleeping, we need to wake them and feed them. I know this is controversial. Some people are going to fight me with on this. I don't think it's controversial. I think that this is an excellent way to support our breast milk supply and our baby as they're feeding until they have regained birth weight. Then if your baby wants to sleep a 4 hour stretch at night, let them. That's fine.
So we wake them, wait, how often at night?
Every two to three hours.
Every 2 to 3 hours. Okay. Got it.
Yep. Every 2 to 3 hours throughout the whole 24 hour day. Sometimes it's more frequent than that too, because they're sad and they're fussy and they just want to be at the breast and that's okay.
Gotcha.
But then, yes. So then let's pretend now your baby is 10 days old and has regained birth weight and is typically kind of giving a longer stretch at some point in the night. Maybe it's 4 hours. Maybe it's even 5 hours. Cool. Mm-hmm. Great. Use it. Utilize it. And sleep. Or now, do you need to pump in the middle of the night for that time period? If you're feeling extremely full and you're worried about mastitis, maybe you just need to take the pressure off. Like you do a little hand expression or you use something like the Hakka to just get a little bit of that engorgement out. But if we don't want to encourage an oversupply, then I wouldn't suggest fully pumping. Your supply needs to be able to regulate to your baby and your baby's needs. This is, again, only in the situation of a baby with a good latch that is gaining well. If your baby has a bad latch, is dealing with a tongue and lip tie, is preemie, is not gaining weight, none of this is going to apply. You're going to have an individualized plan with your doctor or your pediatrician and or probably mostly coming from your lactation consultant, because unfortunately, pediatricians don't know that much about breastfeeding either. Actually, they know very little about breastfeeding. So anyway, that's kind of like the main thing. Now, if your baby is formula fed right off the gate, what you will usually do for the first few days is 1 to 2 ounce bottles every 2 to 3 hours, including at night. And then after they're in that, you know, past that maybe first week-ish, at some point it will transition to larger bottles, like every, you know, maybe like 2 to 3 ounces bottles every 3 to 4 hours. So that's because the composition of formula is different than breast milk. Breast milk is, it is processed or metabolized more efficiently. And so breastfed babies need to feed more frequently. But the amount of the milk at the end of the day is still in that, like around 30, 32 ounces at, you know, after a month of life. And so anyways, that's kind of like the main thing about feeding. Now, something that can happen is like your baby's having reflux. So they're spitting up a lot. Some level of spit up is fine. There are people, or there are going to be babies that are called happy spitters, where they spit up a lot, but their affect is still fine and they're happy. Happy spitters can be confusing because it's like, what's going on here now? Sometimes you don't need to do anything about it as long as they're gaining weight still. But if they're upset and they are like crying a lot and they are grimacing and they're kicking their legs and they're gassy and then they're spitting up, and or sometimes if they're doing all of that and they're not spitting up, they could have something called silent reflux. So you'll need to chat about that with the pediatrician and the IBCLC to figure out, is it something in your milk? Is it something like their latch is getting, it's not sealing properly, so they're getting lots of air and swallowing that, and then that's causing big bubbles, etc. So know that. And then sometimes that's part of the cause of something called colic, which we're gonna not talk about here because that's such a big topic for a whole episode.
And
then also I will link, there's an episode, a couple episodes we have about breastfeeding and tongue lip ties and postpartum in general that could be helpful for this episode, so we'll put those in the show notes as well.
Writing down right now.
And then I want to talk about skin and crying, but do you have any questions about feeding?
No, I think that's good. I think with Avia, I don't know what I was thinking. If I had anxiety that I wouldn't have enough milk or that I needed to have other people feed her. So, because I was pumping after feeding her or something.
Well,
I had so much milk built up and I never used it.
Because
I think probably... I thought that I needed milk for bottles for other people. So I was like, I think I'd feed her and then I'd pump, but then I never used that milk.
So I think that what you probably were doing was pumping after your morning feed, which if people need to get a milk supply up, that is what I suggest. So you feed them in the morning, like after they've woken up, and then you pump because you're going to usually have the most milk in the 24-hour period at that point. So maybe you're pumping even just like 1 ounce, 2 ounces, and you start to store that. And then that's how you start to build your supply for like if you have to go back to work or you have a date night or something like that. You made a lot of milk. You had an oversupply at some point. So you probably just got a lot at that point. But she was getting great and everything was
great. Now, like I know with her, I did have a good supply. So when she would feed on one side, I would put the Hakka on the other side and it would just, it would literally just fill up the Hakka while I was nursing her. So I never had I wouldn't have actually needed to pump, but I do remember pumping. But this time I don't think I'm going to do that because I just don't think I need that.
Yeah, you don't need that much. I did the same thing with the Hakka and I would store up like 20 ounces. And that's kind of all you need to be able to have as like a backup, because every time your baby is getting a bottle, ideally you should be pumping to replace that milk. So you'll always have this sort of like steady state of, you know, say it's 20 ounces in your freezer, whatever it is. But that actually is a question you just brought up that made me think I wanted to mention. People usually wonder, well, when should I start to pump? I would say don't start pumping until about 3 weeks. And then that is when you would introduce your first bottle. If your baby is going to be taking bottles because you're working or you do plan on like lots of date nights and things, I mean, I think it's a good skill for babies to have is to be able to take a bottle. So at all babies really should be exposed to this at some point. Because the situation that I've been in now 3 times where your baby won't take a bottle is a little stressful.
Yeah. When do we introduce the bottle? Because yeah, so AB never took a bottle. Okay. At 3 weeks. And then a big mistake I made, which I think is why she didn't take the bottle, is I never got the nipples that incrementally gave them more milk or something.
You like only stayed with newborn nipples?
Probably. I know I made a big mistake there. And
no,
so that's.
I don't think so. That's good. I think that's a good idea for a breastfed baby to be getting a bottle for a while. You're going to want to use a newborn sized nipple tip. And then you can maybe go and even sometimes preemie. You can go up to like a 1, but I mean, unless you were trying to give her a bottle at like 9 months with a newborn and she wasn't taking it, then it's like at that point at 6 months, you can even teach him how to drink out of a straw cup or an open mouth cup or something like that. So they don't need necessarily to be able to take a bottle, but a newborn, a little baby should be drinking out of either a preemie nipple tip or a newborn nipple tip. If you want to maintain that like no bottle confusion and just wanting to stay at the breast kind of thing. So I don't think you made a mistake. She probably just didn't take one because sometimes babies don't do it. But we also need to try to find the bottles that will. So what it ends up happening usually is that you need to try like multiple different kinds of bottles. This is where ideally, if you have a good community, you can borrow some bottles from friends. You don't have to buy a bunch of them because your baby may never want to take those. And so trying something like the Even Flow has a nice bottle tip that's like a wide base that a lot of breastfed babies will be able to latch on to well. There's a couple now, Emulate, Emulaite, makes one that looks like a nipple and looks like a boob. And they also come in a black version, which is really cool for brown skin. Then there's another one called Mommy, M-O-M-I. And these are all like, they're trying to emulate breastfeeding for breastfed babies that are really particular about bottles and won't take bottles. So sometimes those can be more helpful too.
Gotcha.
Okay. For the sake of just timing, oh, go ahead.
Should we split this into 2 episodes? Because I feel like we have so much to say.
Yeah, we probably should.
I don't know if you have time to record it now. I do, but we'd also don't have to.
I have to go in 15 minutes. Okay. But maybe I can just kind of be quick about this. Well, no,
well, I feel
this
like the information is so valuable and it's like we might as well just buff up and have a second episode.
Okay, let me like flow out of this then. Okay. So at 59 minutes, let's make a little note here, 59 minutes.
Because we haven't talked about skin or crying or diapers. And it's like, I feel like you have so much value instead of rushing it into one.
You're right,
should just have 2.
Okay, let's go back to it. And then I'll just say that we're going to do that.
Okay.
Okay, so I was going to start to transition now into talking about skin things because newborns have really sensitive skin and parents can kind of trip out about what's happening. And it's like, there are some things we should be aware of for sure. And then I wanted to talk about crying and some of the tips for that and also reasons why it happens and then some diaper things as well. But we're just going to split this into 2 episodes because this has been kind of long-winded, but I think it's been valuable. And so instead of rushing, we're just going to make it 2 episodes. So look out for the part 2 where we discuss those things. And I will also kind of throw in, because I think it's important, maybe just like a few health notes about newborns, like some warning signs that I feel like should be maybe common knowledge. But in amongst all of the steep learning curve that parents have to learn, it can be kind of swept under the rug. And then it's sad because it's like there could have been something that was prevented if there was like an emergency that arose, et cetera. So I'll put in like a little newborn first aid. It's not going to be that many things, but just a few things. So anyway, I hope that you appreciated this and hopefully it'll help you with your prep here. And then this episode 2 as well can continue to be helpful.
Amazing. This has been so helpful. I feel like you are such a wealth of knowledge. It's amazing that you know so many things. And I'm so happy that you're my best friend, but I am also happy that other people get to benefit from your knowledge and it's not just me.
Oh, thanks. That makes me feel really nice. I'm glad that it's helpful for you. It is kind of like a trip heading into having a baby and needing to know all the things. My goal here is not to overwhelm people, but just to give them the information that is helpful and also like a little bit middle ground in the mindset because it's just, you know, like with everything that we talk about, you can have a plan. And I think it's important to have a plan. I think it's important to go into all of this having a lot of base knowledge and goals of what you wish to happen. And then also it is not just about us anymore. So yeah. We have a full sentient being baby in front of us who is going to really teach us a lot of lessons, and we need to be able to flow with them. And I think that's just something that I don't hear enough in some of the messaging around, you know, motherhood prep and childcare and pediatrics and things, is that idea. So I like to emphasize it. So anyways, okay, well, we will pop back on for part two, and thank you for everything.
Yep. Thank you.
Bye. Kids get sick. It's natural and normal. And there are things we can do to support their immune systems naturally that help not only with symptoms, but the progression of the illness. I've made a course that highlights all of my top immune support remedies and home care methods to support your children, from newborns all the way through to big kids. I discuss herbs, homeopathics, nutraceutical supplements, targeted nutrients, using nature as medicine, hydrotherapy practices at home, and more. The Winter is Coming webinar is a natural cold and flu course for kiddos that you'll want to revisit again and again. Find the link in the show notes. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Healthy as a Mother podcast. In order for others to hear this information, please leave a review with Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and send to a friend who could benefit from this content. We're so excited to share more on becoming and being a mother next time.
And please remember that the ideas and views of this podcast are for informational purposes only and are not intended to serve as a substitute for medical care of any kind, including the diagnosis or treatment of any illness or disease. Consult with your provider before integrating this information into your own care plan. And remember, a healthier future starts now, and it starts with you.